Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. With the exception of the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, many countries from around the world at a UN climate change conference in Poland last week decided on how to put the 2015 Paris Agreement into practice. President Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement and does not believe climate change is being caused by human activities. The Poland conference may not have achieved everything that many nations wanted, but it was a step toward trying to reduce carbon emissions. Our guest today was at that conference. Dr. Donald Brown is a scholar in residence and professor of sustainability ethics and law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. He's also or was a contributing author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Fifth Assessment. Dr. Brown, welcome back to the program.
Thanks again for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, now, the conference was known as COP24. Before we get started with what was accomplished and what wasn't at COP24, give us a sense, if you would, the scale of this conference. How large was it?
It's enormous. There are 195 countries have delegations. Some of the delegations are big. There were 32,800 people registered for the conference. Every scientific organization in the world, many universities. And so every country now has a pavilion, which they're bragging about what they're trying to do. So it's the ambition of these conferences is way beyond simply negotiating text. It's trying to communicate what's going on. And that's one of the reasons I go, is because for me every year it's a refresher on what's actually happening and not happening in the world.
You mentioned 195 countries.
Right.
Did 195 countries participate in the conference this month?
Yes. And they all signed the final document. They all signed, including the United States. Although the United States was reportedly trying to undermine parts of the text, it finally agreed to the final text, which would allow the U.S. to stay in if Trump reverses his position to pull out.
Yeah, President Trump said that the United States is pulling out, that can't happen until 2020, correct?
That is correct.
So that can be reversed.
Yes. We can't actually pull out until 2020. The Paris Agreement stipulates that.
But even though the United States and Donald Trump has said that the United States will pull out in 2020, what is the United States doing now to, I mean, I imagine if the country is still, the nation is still part of that agreement that was agreed to in 2015, that there were some things that had to go along with that. Is the country, is the U.S. doing anything to live up to that agreement?
Well, the U.S. is still sort of bound by a commitment that the Obama administration made. It hasn't reversed that. The Obama administration committed to reduce greenhouse gases by 26% to 28% below 2005 by 2025. So as far as the rest of the world is concerned, we're still bound by that, but we're not doing anything that shows that we're actually on a path to reduce emissions by that amount.
One of the things that got so much attention at the conference was that there was a side event that the United States had that was promoting coal. Tell me about that.
Yeah, before I comment on that, also I heard during my time there incredible anger at the United States for what Trump is doing on rolling back on regulations at a moment in history where the science is saying we have an existential crisis for the human race and for about 25 or 30 countries in particular. So the U.S. was participating, but the side event got huge derision. Many times I heard people say in various meetings that the United States was guilty of some new kind of horrible crime against humanity, particularly from the countries that are already very vulnerable, where there's already human suffering, small island developing states, African states, cities in Asia that are on the coast, cities in Asia that depend upon glaciers for farming water in the summertime, and the glaciers are disappearing. So there is enormous anxiety, anger at the U.S. for its failure to do anything meaningful on this existential problem for the entire universe, human race.
When you are in a conference and you hear that kind of criticism, that kind of anger as an American, how do you respond to that?
Well, almost everyone I talk to will also, after they express anger, they also say, we like Americans, we know that Trump does not represent all Americans, and we're still hopeful. And they know that most of the Americans that are appearing there are trying to support a global effort. So I've never experienced any personal anger, although I frequently hear claims of anger, disappointment, disenchantment with the United States.
So before we get into your observations, what was agreed to at the Poland conference?
Well, the ambition of this conference was pretty modest compared to other conferences. This is the 24th conference. The goal of this conference was to develop the rules necessary to make the Paris Agreement meaningful. Those rules are very, very important. I'll just tell you one story why. I did a research project with the University of Auckland Law School. We got 24 researchers in 24 countries to figure out what actually happened in countries that were claiming they were abiding by the climate treaty. And we discovered that most countries, although they claim they were abiding by the 2 degrees centigrade goal of the climate treaty and to reduce their emissions based upon equity, many countries were actually basing their targets on national economic interest. But you couldn't tell that from what they submitted. So forcing governments to be specific in quantitative terms about how they are implementing their commitments under the climate treaty is incredibly practically important, because there's no enforcement mechanism under the Paris Agreement except shaming countries that fail to do what they promised to do. So the rule book turns out to be incredibly practically necessary to allow people to critically evaluate what countries are actually doing compared to what they say they're doing. So that was the major goal of this. There are several other goals about finance and adaptation and several other goals, but the major goal was to complete what is called the rule book. And that's incredibly practically important, to give people around the world the tools to critically evaluate what countries are actually doing compared to what they're bragging they're doing.
That's disturbing.
Yep.
I mean, that is very disturbing when you're looking at 24 countries, mm-hmm. and they're looking out for their own economic interest rather than what they say they're going to do. And as you said, there really is no mechanism in place to keep them from doing that. What's to say that even, you know, with this agreement in place, that nations going forward will adhere to what they've agreed to?
There's a lot of reason to be skeptical, pessimistic. The countries are actually going to do what they said to do. The only thing we have is critical review of what they actually did compared to what they said they would do. That's the only, and this came out of Obama. Obama insisted with the world that the Paris Agreement not be enforceable. And the rest of the world agreed to that because they knew that if it were enforceable, it would have to be ratified by the US Senate. And that was impossible. So amazingly, the rest of the world agreed with President Obama's suggestion that it not be enforceable, because the rest of the world knew that's the best Obama could do. So what we have left is shaming countries for failing to do what they promised to do. Now, shaming has actually worked in international law in other contexts. I teach international human rights law, and shaming sometimes does work, but that's all we have.
You know, Don, I have to say that if we have a certain amount of time. And I mean, the report earlier last month said that we could be looking at 12 years before we start seeing some, well, we're already seeing some the impact of climate change, but we have about 12 years to turn this around. I have to tell you that I don't feel real confident when shaming is the only way to do that.
Yeah, I tell people I'm very pessimistic, but I'm still hopeful. Okay, I'm a pessimist about what's going to happen, but there's some reason to be hopeful. And that's a long story in itself, why one would be. There are countries that are really starting to step up. There are something like 4,000 cities that are setting greenhouse gases at zero carbon, at least in the electricity sector. So around the world, there all of a sudden, there is reason for hope. None of these hopeful developments are nearly enough to do what the world needs to do to prevent catastrophic warming. One other thing about the context. The context was pretty gloomy in light of three or four recent scientific reports. You mentioned the one from IPCC, in which IPCC talked about what it would take to limit warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade and why if we wait till 2 degrees centigrade, there's huge risks of catastrophic harm.
And just for context, background sake, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And when you're talking about it, it's 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. They're saying that would have grave consequences if temperatures rose above that.
Right. So that was one of the reports that came out shortly before the conference. But there were several other reports that should scare the hell out of us, okay? And that's the way the scientists are seeing it. There was one report that came out, U.S. Academy of Sciences report, that said the reason why the world agreed to 2 degrees, between 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade, there was some scientific reason to believe you wouldn't start to trigger rapid nonlinear climate surprises until you got above 2 degrees centigrade. But there's recent evidence that it's starting to happen at 1.1 degrees centigrade. There was a paper by the National Academy of Sciences that said the permafrost, methane from permafrost, is starting to be triggered now. Okay, so before the conference, it was pretty gloomy in preventing catastrophic harm to the human race based upon the most recent science. It's not only the one that you report on, there are several other recent scientific reports that said, oh my God, we need an all-hands-on-deck global approach to this problem, and we're not close to doing what we need to do.
So let's get back to the conference. What wasn't agreed to?
Well, a rule book was agreed to, but there are several things Americans, the press is doing a terrible job on covering them. One is about finance. In the 1992 treaty that George H.W. Bush signed, the rich countries agreed that because they largely caused the problem and the poor countries are largely the most vulnerable, the rich countries have a duty to help finance both mitigation and adaptation in the poor countries. At the Paris Agreement, the United States agreed that at minimum the developed countries should make available $100 billion of finance for developing countries. And if that doesn't happen, it's in our interest to make that happen because developing countries can't afford to move rapidly into green technology without some financial support. And if we don't help them with adaptation, we're going to get refugees destabilizing the world. So it's in our interest. We're both legally and practically we need to think about and fulfill our commitments on finance. It's a topic that I'm really critical of the U.S. press. It never covers it. It's often the big issue in the climate negotiations. And the other thing is that the developed countries have to go much faster than the poor countries in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, because as you start to run out of emissions, there's nothing left for the poor countries unless the high-emitting countries go first. So very little work was done on those. Developing countries hoped that there would be a new commitment on finance from developing countries. Repeating, developed countries agreed to $100 billion a year, but have only provided $50 billion a year. And some of the experts on finance say we already know that $180 billion a year is already desperately needed. So that was not completed. It's been at the heart of the differences in the climate negotiations, and the press, in my view, is doing a terrible job in covering it.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about the UN Climate Change Conference in Poland last week was there to maybe put some rules in place for the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Our guest today was there in Poland earlier this month, Dr. Donald Brown, who is a scholar in residence, professor of sustainability, ethics, and law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. He also was a contributing author to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Fifth Assessment, has been a negotiator in the past, as you have heard even during our short conversation here. He's been very involved with the issue of climate change for the past two decades. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Don, I want to talk a little bit more about what we were discussing before the break, and that is the financing aspect of this. I mean, there are a lot of different factors or thoughts that go into this, and a lot of them reach into politics. The president was elected on an America First, guarding our borders, that kind of thing. That was his platform, when he was running for president. Let's face it, immigration is one of his, and that's a big part of this. I think it's a sure thing that the administration, the president, doesn't see a benefit to the United States for providing, along with other Western countries or developed countries, $100 billion to help these undeveloped or, these other countries to adapt to climate change. So there's one thing right there. I mean, the politics of it, you would hate to think that, well, we know it for sure, that this has become such a political issue, but it even goes to that point. So, I mean, I would be pessimistic that the United States during the Trump administration is going to provide the kind of funding that was agreed to.
Yeah, I certainly agree one should be pessimistic whether the United States is going to provide any funding. But it is a huge, indefensible, morally reprehensible, practically stupid thing, because If you don't help the developing countries reduce emissions, it's going to hurt us. Okay? Climate change is unlike other problems. Everyone is filling up the atmospheric bath.
Yeah, it doesn't stop at the American border.
So U.S. is already contributing to killing hundreds of millions of people. Climate change is already creating refugees, particularly in Africa. The refugees are destabilizing the world, particularly. Climate change is already destabilizing the global economic system.
In what way?
Well, because refugees, particularly from Africa, are invading Europe, which is moving, which is creating political disorder in Europe, undermining the leadership potential of the European community. The EU has been the global leader on this for two decades.
But is climate change contributing to the refugee crisis?
Because take the Sahel countries on the south of the Sahara. 30 years ago, we predicted there would be drought there, and they could not feed themselves. So now there are millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa and the Horn of Africa and some other parts of the world, they have to leave their country or they die, okay? So Syria was actually, the Syrian crisis was actually caused by a drought in Syria where there's a severe drought and the farmers all moved into the cities in Syria. So the military has known for 30 years that climate change is becomes a military problem.
It's a national security
issue. It's a national security issue. So for us not to, it's in our interest, you know, if compassion triggered by the fact that we're causing this suffering, if that doesn't do it, there is a national interest in contributing to adaptation and financing mitigations. And it's profoundly stupid for the U.S. not to participate with the rest of the world in helping the developing countries. It's practically necessary. It's also legally required under both the Climate Treaty and the Paris Agreement. The U.S. agreed that it has an obligation in the 1992 treaty to help with financing, repeated that promise in the 2015 Paris Agreement.
When you say adaptation, what do you mean by adaptation?
Well, adaptation means different things. It means helping farmers with crops that can't, changing crops that no longer thrive in a warmer world, helping them with water, manage their water supply, helping countries that are the most vulnerable countries in the world, the small island developing states, the oceans are rising, they're going to have to move their cities away from the water. And a lot of poor countries can't do what now it seems to be necessary to protect their citizens.
All right, so let's talk about some of the other observations that you have. You sent me a list of some of the observations that you had from the conference. One of the things, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, the magnitude and speed of global reductions necessary to prevent the catastrophe. Said earlier that the IPCC talked about having about a dozen years before, you know, we may be at a point where it's irreversible.
The IPCC report said to limit warming to 1.5 degrees, the whole world, every country must reduce its emissions by 45% by 2030. That's 12 years from now. That if we don't do that, then the probability of limiting the warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade becomes virtually impossible. And the whole world must be carbon zero by 2050. That means we have to start getting out of not only coal, but natural gas. So the policy implications of the Paris Agreement are poorly understood. They're profoundly important for the global community. And we need to talk about, the only way to deal with a crisis is to treat it as a crisis. And it's not only the magnitude, it's the speed that you have to do this. Every day you wait to reduce the emissions, you're making the problem worse because you're consuming what a carbon budget that must be lived within to limit the warming to this. So it's not only the magnitude, it's the speed. We act in the United States as if we have all the time in the world to solve this problem. People get fooled by thinking, well, we can meet this target 10 years from now, but if you wait 10 years, the problem's 10 years worse, and the target has to go up.
There have been many elected leaders, people in this country, who have pointed out that emissions in the United States have gone down in recent years, and they point to that as saying that, see, what we're doing now is working.
Well, that claim is, it needs to be examined much more critically. People make that claim, but that's only true if the emissions have gone down largely because shifting from coal to natural gas. But if the methane leakage rate is greater than 3%, combustion of natural gas is actually worse.
So methane from where?
Methane is a byproduct combustion of natural gas, okay. So natural gas is only about half the CO2 that coal has, but if the methane leakage from natural gas facilities is greater than 3%, combusting natural gas is actually a greater producer of carbon dioxide. So there's still the claim that is going down. There are reductions being made in the U.S. and many in some places, but it is an open question quantitatively actually how much they're going down.
Seems to be a lot of questions about this.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're talking about questions about how much emissions are going down and what you said earlier right. about that some countries were cheating or you know, not living up to their word with the agreement. I mean, we're talking the entire world, 195 right. countries.
Right.
It seems like an awful big order to
It's huge, okay? And there's a lot of reason to be pessimistic, okay? So I try to But I tried to focus on what's hopeful, okay? That's why the rule book is so important, okay, to make the countries very specifically report on what emissions they reduced and why. There's a whole nother thing that the U.S. press never talks about. It's called equity. Under both the Paris Agreement and the Climate Treaty, countries agree to reduce their emissions to prevent dangerous climate change, but to do it on the basis of equity. You can't solve this problem unless countries' emissions commitments are consistent with what fairness requires of them. It's legally required and it's practically required. We could talk about equity all day. No one ever talks about it. But when you go to the climate negotiations, these are the big issues under discussion. What is the U.S. fair share compared to China's, or
You know, when you've talked about the media doing a lousy job covering this, I have to say that often when we hear reports in the media about climate change, okay, we may hear, like when the IPCC report came out last month, may hear about some of the data and some of the information that was put there, but it often focuses on the debate of whether it's actually happening or not. I hate to say it, but it focuses on what the Trump administration is doing, what it's not doing. We often don't hear about what would you like to see the media cover? What do Americans need to know?
Okay, there are six things Americans need to know that are not covered. I've actually written about this. One is the magnitude, one is the speed, one is the practical need to set your emissions target based upon equity. Another is the practical need to finance the emissions. So there are practical things that Americans need to know, and the press is only covering one or two of them, and they're doing it poorly, in my view. These are the issues in the negotiations that are causing disagreement, and the press hardly ever covers any of it.
Hmm. I would think that part of that is, and I just have to say that very often when it comes to a complicated scientific issue like this, that the media doesn't. It's not the strong suit of the media to do that. And I think a lot of times it's because Americans don't have the interest in that.
Well,
I'm not trying to justify it.
Well, I'll give you another explanation of this phenomenon. I think you accurately describe what's going on. But what we talk about are the issues that have been focused on by the opponents of climate change. The media has been tricked to cover the debate which was formulated by the opponents. For 35 years, we've debated two things about climate change to the exclusion of everything else. One is scientific uncertainty. We shouldn't act until there's more certainty. And the other thing we've debated is what will it cost the U.S. economy? So 90% of the coverage is focused on issues that the opponents of climate change have framed. Okay. Philosophers talk about this as of instrumental rationality. That economic interest forces are successful in framing the public debate, and they've been successful for 35 years. And they've spent a lot of money to undermine the science, to make outrageous claims about it will destroy the economy, and completely overlooking the enormous harm both to the United States and the rest of the world, and what is the U.S. fair share. So the framing is, a sociologist will tell you that if you can frame an issue, you can win the issue.
Don, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And I'm always fascinated to hear, maybe fascinated is not the right word, but learn what actually goes on at these conferences around the world. Next year, COP will be in Peru. So what happens between now and then? What comes out of this?
Well, all year long, the governments are meeting and trying to develop the agenda. So there are constant meetings. They're often in Bonn, Germany, or different parts of the world. So there's nonstop negotiations trying to get the next meeting towed up with a text that people have some hope can be negotiated.
Well, I'm sure we'll be in touch and have you on the program again. Don Brown, Dr. Donald Brown, is scholar in residence and professor of sustainability ethics and law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Don, thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, an NPR investigation into black lung disease in coal country. And also, ERs, emergency rooms, are often the first place mental illnesses are diagnosed. Those are the topics that we'll be discussing on tomorrow's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in. A recent demographic assessment by a D.C.-based analytics firm has drawn an interesting conclusion. Their findings show that Dauphin County is statistically closest to resembling America as a whole. It's called the Middle America Project. The analysis was made using a host of statistical variables: income, voting patterns, race, religious affiliation, and a wide range of social and demographic characteristics. We're going to talk about Dauphin County being representative of Middle America with Patrick Ruffini. He's partner and co-founder of Echelon Insights, which conducted this analysis. Mr. Ruffini, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I listed some of the criteria you had for your analysis. But Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, the county, the community that so closely resembles America as a whole, in what ways?
Sure. As you mentioned, we looked at a whole different host of variables. And oftentimes, you know, when it comes to elections, we talk about bellwether counties. We talk about places that, you know, have voted like the rest of the country. But that has shifted over time, right? So that's not always the same. You have counties that, you know, particularly in this last election, that kind of really upended the political map. Sort of the places that are sort of bellwether politically are no longer maybe bellwether politically. And, we have a new set of places. So our motivation here was kind of to really update those assumptions for, kind of the current state of things. And update it for all the ways that America is changing, not just politically, but demographically. We found that, for example, the country as a whole voted, you know, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by two percentage points, and Dauphin County, she took the county by 3 percentage points on factors like income. Dauphin County very closely matches the country as a whole. Demographics, racial breakdown, very closely matches the country as a whole. Education rates very closely matches the country as a whole in a way that almost no other, you really have, maybe four or five other counties in the country that are even competitive. One of them happens to be Lehigh County, and also in Pennsylvania, home of Allentown, which finished second. So there does seem to be, something happening in, Pennsylvania, sort of outside, Philly and Pittsburgh, That seems to, you know, you all seem to reflect, I think, some of these national trends a little bit more.
And just to be clear, this is based entirely on statistics, right?
That's right. I mean, we wanted, there was absolutely no subjective judgment that, you know, went into this in terms of, you know, what we decided to look at. We looked at over a dozen different measures, both, you know, how a county voted in the last election. We looked at a variety of different measures from the U.S. Census. We looked at, you know, religious patterns as well. So yes, I mean, we selected certain variables, but you know what we find is no matter how you weight the different variables, Dauphin County does still tend to come out ahead.
You know, I think that there were some people who were surprised when the news came out of your report, because the words Middle America were used. And I don't know, I think a lot of Americans have a vision in their mind, a picture in their mind of Middle America. And, you know, they're thinking of, you know, some place in the Midwest. And I'm not just talking about geographically, that, you know, this is an average American community. And they're thinking of it as different than statistically, this is the closest community that represents America as a whole. You find that as well?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we actually addressed that a little bit. Like, yeah, I think the term Middle America gets used and, you know, often in the context of the Midwest. And you have this image of it as, you know, a very rural, small town, you know, authentic type of place that's sort of far away from the coast, far away from the cities, a slower pace of life, all of those things that we sort of have in our mind. And, you know, while that image is still valid, we are a fairly urban country. And I think that, you know, a lot of the reaction to the 2016 election, you know, on the part of people, you know, who are reporting from inside the Beltway, who are looking at this and saying, what did we miss? You know, why weren't we able to sort of detect this, you know, this groundswell that we saw for Donald Trump when it came down to the general election? Why didn't we expect him to win? And so a lot of people have ventured out into places, you know, they go to West Virginia, they go to places that Donald Trump won overwhelmingly. And I think that's helpful, right? In the sense of, you know, if you're going from a place that's very blue, you want to understand places that are very red. But I think in some ways that perpetuates the divisions that we, you know, the stereotype of division that we have in our country, that we basically think places are either all blue or all red. And what we're finding is, no, there's quite a bit of purple in between. So we want to find that exact, what is that exact purple place, not just politically, but also in terms of reflecting sort of the overall social and economic mix of the country.
So if I'm to go one step further, if someone wanted to find out what Americans as a whole were thinking, they would come to Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, and talk to the people of Dauphin County.
And that's often, yeah, I think that could be the case, right? I mean, I could see us going there for, you know, having a focus group discussion or having, those conversations. Oftentimes, you know, when we do a lot of those, and we do a lot of those as a company, I've often found, and part of the, part of a little of our motivation is, we're often finding ourselves going to bigger cities that are outside, maybe not, like, they're sort of outside the D.C. Beltway bubble, but they're still bigger cities, and that tend to be bluer, or there's the suburbs of big cities. And, you know, I was kind of like, thinking about, well, wait a second, that doesn't seem to be exactly the sort of middle point here. Like, you know, in terms of finding a place that has the right, you know, kind of the exact mix of blue and red that we would see elsewhere in the country, it has has it all in terms of having the mix of the types of people that, you know, sort of are reflective of our, you know, growing, increasingly diverse country. And so, and that's what we, you know, and that's, you know, we found Dauphin County was actually, so I wouldn't be surprised if you kind of see both political types maybe going to a place like this. We've gotten a lot of feedback on this from reporters who say that thank you so much, because you know they're always looking for places to go and travel to understand the underlying trends. But also, you know, I think if you're talking about because we take into account other factors other than politics, I could see, you know, Dauphin County being a test market for a certain type of product.
Marketing as well as politics. I can see that there could be a lot of different organizations, industries, just a whole lot would take this this information that you've gathered and be able to use it.
Yeah, we agree. So, you know, we have this stereotype. I mean, you have this phrase, will it play in Peoria? You know, that's sort of that's always been like the sort of image that we've had of our, this is the smack dab in the middle of America. And we found actually Peoria, Illinois, is the number 5 county, but Dauphin County actually, you know, beats it.
So, you know, the cliche should be, would it play in Dauphin County? In your findings, you mentioned the changing political landscape in Pennsylvania. What are you referring to?
You know, I used to live in Pennsylvania, and I, you know, remember when I used to live in Pennsylvania, the big battleground was the Philadelphia suburbs, right? You have Philadelphia City, which is obviously very blue, but you had the suburbs, which used to be a little bit purple, maybe leaned red a little bit, and that has shifted pretty dramatically in such a way that, you know, a lot of those counties, not uniformly, but they're more blue and more democratic in their orientation, but you've had the central part of the state, the western part of the state, move dramatically Republican enough so that, you know, Donald Trump was, you know, famously able to win as the first Republican to do so since 1988 and win the state, and that was obviously very instrumental to his win nationally. So I think as the different parts of the state have come apart, it does feel like central Pennsylvania, specifically, you know, counties around, you know, Harrisburg, counties, you know, Lancaster, but, you know, even going, you know, to northeast Pennsylvania, have become a little bit more of the battleground. And I think that's sort of indicative and emblematic of what we found in this, that, you know, if you want to understand not just the political divide. If you understand what's actually driving the political divide, you know, I think like these findings are pretty consistent with those general overall political trends that we've seen over the last few years in Pennsylvania.
You know, political consultant James Carville famously said, now this was, you know, 20 years ago, that Pennsylvania is
right.
Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with Alabama in between. And that was not meant as a compliment, but what he was saying was that you had Philadelphia, you had Pittsburgh, and then it was conservative in the rest of the state. Again, that was a remark that was made 20 years ago. But there are still many people who think of central Pennsylvania as being very conservative. This analysis would tend to refute that.
I think it's now the middle. I think it's evolved to being the, you know, kind of the bellwether of the state. It's actually much more, you know, much more of the swing part of the state. I mean, the overall balance, I would say, I mean, obviously accepting some of the trends from the just completed election, which were pretty good for Democrats overall. But the overall trend in presidential races has been for Pennsylvania to move slightly, you know, slightly more red and slightly more Republican over the last few times. And so, you know, I think it is now become, and it's going to be critical in 2020. And, you know, central Pennsylvania, I think, has become the swing part of the swing state in, you know, in an election, you know, that, you know, will probably be decided by very closely by a few states.
Mm. You know, I'm curious when you say that Dauphin County is the community that is most representative of Middle America. What about the other end of the spectrum? As you did this analysis, where in the country is the least representative of America?
So because so it's both places like, you know, where we are, the Washington, D.C. Beltway bubble is actually turns out to be very unrepresentative of America because, you know.
Boy, there's a shock.
No, it is. And it's not just like a stereotype. I mean, it's actually true in terms of You know, we have much higher incomes than the rest of the country. We have much higher rates of people who have completed a bachelor's degree, which tends to be indicative of a lot of other things, right? So you have both on that side of the spectrum, you have the places that, you know, the sort of stereotype of the out-of-touch beltway elite, you know, we find that to be the case. But you also, you know, going out further, you know, on the other extreme end of the spectrum, you know, you'd also have to say that, you know, a lot of the rural Appalachia, you know, types of counties that, again, have been really heavily focused on as a sort of driver. I mean, they weren't really the driver of a lot of the shifts we saw in the last election, but I think that a lot of people have got it in their heads that some of that particularly some of these, you know, I'm talking about Kentucky, West Virginia, places like that, that those were the decisive places, that those actually tend to be pretty unrepresentative as well, just because of the exact opposite reasons of why a Washington, D.C. They're very poor. They, you know, have low rates of education. They're much older. So I think we wanted to pinpoint, I mean, we don't want to like single anyone out as being like, oh, you don't represent America. I think we want to pinpoint the places that are, you know, just, you know, America in microcosm. And, you know, maybe these are places, you know, we can just in terms of thinking about them, you know, and in terms of, you know, whether it's places marketers would want to go, political reporters would want to go. I think we wanted to pinpoint what are those places.
Were there any surprises in this report? I mean, when you go into an analysis, I would think that it's sometimes a little bit of a challenge not to have some preconceived ideas. And then when you get the actual data,
yeah,
that you say, oh, that's a little bit of a surprise. Were there some surprises in this report?
You know, I think so. I think that in particular, you look at, you know, when we talk about middle America, we've made a very conscious decision to call it that because just to sort of update our view of what middle America is, that it's not just places, you know, again, it's not just places in the Midwest, but we found actually a place like a state like California actually scores pretty highly, right? A state like there's places, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, as being, it was actually the biggest, the most typical big city in the country. So you have a lot of places out west. You also have a lot of places up in the Northeast, in New York, Connecticut. So places that are on the coast, but maybe not stereotypically, not the stereotypical big cities. And what we find accounts for that is, you know, America is 17% Hispanic now. And in particular, and you have a really big divide in that population where you have a lot of Hispanics out west in the Southwest, in Texas, in California, in places like that. And that's a component of the analysis. So it's not just like we're trying to find that quintessential sort of old town, you know, small town America of the 1950s.
That's exactly what I was thinking, is the 1950s, right? America that was overwhelmingly white, very few African Americans, no Latinos. That's not America today.
That's right. And so, you know, you need to, you know, in order to score highly on that part of it, you'd need to be pretty close to 17% Hispanic, which is, you know, a big number. It's bigger than the African-American population, for example. And so, you know, what we find is a lot of places out west, although, you know, not like San Francisco, not Silicon Valley, not some of the which actually do score pretty, you know, low on this measure. But a lot of places, you know, Los Angeles, for example, scores pretty high. You know, Phoenix scores pretty high. A lot of places in Florida score pretty high based on that.
Hmm. We're almost out of time. Will this be an annual thing, or how often will you do this kind of analysis? Because the country will be changing all the time.
It will be. I mean, it remains to be seen whether we do it annually. I mean, government statistics only come out every few years. So, you know, I think we do look forward to updating this, you know, and particularly heading into the 2020 election season, definitely for sure after the 2020 election, because that will be a big data point for us. But I think that we've seen, you know, certainly a lot of interest in this. And we'd love to see how it kind of shapes out over time.
Patrick Ruffini is the partner and co-founder of Echelon Insights, which conducted the Middle America Project, found that Dauphin County is the most statistically closest to resembling America as a whole. Mr. Ruffini, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure, thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, again, we'll be talking about black lung disease in cold countries and mental illness being diagnosed in emergency rooms.